From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and guess who's coming to town? You know, the Pope. And not just any Pope, a very 21st century Pope.
He's making a statement. He's telling us, well, if the church is going to be the church of the poor, it needs to change. We need to resemble the poor. We need to kind of get off our high horses in many ways and start walking with the people.
Pope Francis is reinvigorating Catholics and finding love in some unlikely places.
We are in this ridiculous position that we are defending the Pope. We never imagined.
It's not all love, though, especially when it comes to a controversial figure.
People were enslaved in the missions. They were whipped if they spoke their language. Girls who were unwed were locked in dorms that were filthy.
Today, the life and times of El Papa Francisco. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Hey there. Before we get back to our show, I want to tell you about a few recent interviews you can check out on Fresh Air's podcast. Host Terry Gross interviewed Jonathan Franzen about his new novel. She spoke with the author of a book about autism and the myths surrounding it. And she did a tribute to neurologist Oliver Sacks, featuring a couple of her interviews with Sacks from Fresh Air's archive. You'll find those and many other great Fresh Air interviews on npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And on this episode, El Papa, the Pope. And I'm here with Yasmin Khan. She's a reporter at WNYC right here in New York City. Hey, Yasmin.
Hi, Maria.
You recently spent some time with a woman named Teresa.
That's right. Teresa Argudo. One of those people with loads of lost vacation days because they went unused for too long. Her job is pretty demanding.
Jefa?
Her jefa is the head of the New York City school system, Carmen Farina.
Oh, my God. Okay, so that is a very big job.
She is in charge of the chancellor's schedule, so as you can imagine, it gets pretty intense sometimes.
Maite, we'd like to see you just for 2 minutes, and Ernest standing outside. So
she's extremely devoted, but she will be taking a day off for someone very special, Pope Francis.
So she's going to see El Papa, of course. Who else?
As you know, the Pope is coming to New York City later this month for his first visit to the U.S. Teresa is very excited. She entered a lottery to see the Pope's procession in Central Park.
And it's just by lottery. It's kind of like good luck, right?
It's by lottery.
So she's going to take off of work?
She's determined to take a personal day, and even her boss, Carmen Farina, gets it.
You know, all of us are obsessed about somebody. She's obsessed about the Pope.
So Teresa is originally from Ecuador. And as a fellow South American, she feels an affinity with Pope Francis, who's from Argentina. And when he comes to New York, she said, it'd be great to give him a hug. She understands if that can't happen. But she just wants to be there in the crowd, smiling. And even thinking about it, her emotions bubble to the surface.
I want him to see me, that I'm smiling, that I'm letting him know that I'm happy with his work.
That's extraordinary to hear, getting so emotional just about wanting to maybe be there.
I mean, she's really moved by him. And the way she puts it, you know, she's moved by his humility, by his focus on inequality. That's very important to her. But the raw excitement that she feels about his visit is really about her faith in God.
To me, God is everything, you know, from the beginning of my day to the end of my day. And he's the one who's in charge of my life. He's the one that guides my steps. He's the one that, you know, take me to wherever I am.
And her devotion, you know, that deep sense of love and loyalty also applies to her family and to her parish of more than 30 years. And both of these loves come together on Sundays. She and her husband, Rafael, attend the Spanish Mass at a Brooklyn church that shares the same name as the Pope, St. Francis of Assisi. It was a whole family affair. And afterwards, after Mass, the family affair continued with a big Ecuadorian meal at the Argudo home in Queens. That was a real treat. Her husband, Rafael, prepared Ecuadorian ceviche with shrimp, while Teresa made her mother's recipe for chicken and rice.
It's not your usual arroz con pollo.
Chicken with rice.
Because this one has raisins and pepper.
So I was watching her take her work really seriously in the kitchen, like with her own job. Everything is a labor of love. Each task is something to be cared for. And it's kind of as if hard work is part of her religion, too.
You have to work, work, and work after that for your dreams, for what you want.
Of course, she passed this work ethic on to her children. And her daughter, Karina, told me it makes sense that her mother also works hard to be a woman of faith.
I think my mom has always been, like, very devoted. There's never been a slacker moment.
So if your mom says she's determined to meet the Pope, knowing who she is...
Oh, she's going to do it. She's going to do it. She's going to make it happen.
Of course. I'm going to take a personal day. And I'm going to be welcoming the Pope. And I'm going to tell him, Bienvenido, Panchito.
Bienvenido, Panchito. I've never heard anyone say that for this Pope.
Yeah, she's...
Panchito.
It's like she knows him already.
You really think she's going to get a chance to meet him?
I do.
She's going to push her way to the front.
I believe, as she told me, she's a woman of faith. So I believe that she's going to make it happen.
That was Yasmin Khan. She's a reporter for WNYC right here in New York City. On September 22nd, Pope Francis, or Panchito, as Teresa calls him, arrives in Washington, D.C. to start a historic six-day visit that includes speaking before Congress, meeting with President Obama, holding a mass at Madison Square Garden in New York, and making several other stops, including churches, a school in Spanish Harlem, a prison in Philadelphia. As Yasmin said, this is his first ever trip to the United States after an equally historic trip to Cuba. It's hard to believe Pope Francis has held office for just 2.5 years. In that short time, he's injected new energy into the church and steered it in a direction that few could have anticipated. His arrival feels so fresh, so filled with hope for U.S. Catholics who have struggled to stand by the church's traditions. Over just the past few weeks, he's expedited the process of annulling marriages and made it easier for women to seek forgiveness for abortion. He even apologized to the indigenous people of the Americas for crimes committed against them in the name of the church throughout history. This is a pope who refuses to wear those overly ornate outfits and those hats, who has criticized trickle-down economics, and I never thought I would actually be following a pope on Twitter. Now, whether all of these changes are sensible or radical is a matter of debate, but there's no debating that we are dealing with a 21st century pope. Not to mention, he's the first Latin American pope, an Argentinian child born of Italian immigrants. And that has special meaning to the over 20 million Latino Catholics who live in the United States, people just like Teresa Argudo. So, on today's show, we're looking at the church and its charismatic leader and the impact he's having on believers and non-believers alike.
Well, right from the beginning, when the first words that came out of his mouth were, "Please bless me. I ask for your blessing."
This is Dr. Hosman Ospino talking about the very first thing Francis did when he was elected in May of 2013. From the very start, Dr. Ospino says, Pope Francis was doing things his way.
That was completely unorthodox because everybody was expecting that the Pope would actually bless everyone. Also, he will just stand in this high place and bless the audience. But then he asks for the people to bless him. And that somehow sent a message across the crowd looking at him and across the world that let everybody know that this Pope was onto something different.
Ospino is a professor of religious education and Hispanic ministry at Boston College, a Jesuit school. His focus is on the dialogue between theology and culture. I think that for me, when I heard that the Pope was saying, I do not want to wear those shoes, and I do not want to travel in that Pope-mobile, and I do not want to be staying in, you know, the, you know, five-star residence— those things were the things that for me, as someone who was raised Catholic and then left the church, they made me just stop and turn around and say, is that possible that this Pope is doing it? And I have to be honest, there was also a part of me that was like, is this just great marketing.
A lot of people are somewhat scandalized because the Pope is leaving these symbolism and these rituals behind. Immediately, he's making a statement. He's telling us, well, if the church is going to be the church of the poor, it needs to change. We need to resemble the poor. We need to kind of get off our high horses in many ways and start walking with the people. And all the Pope is doing is just preaching the gospel. If the Pope wants everybody, every Catholic in the world, to live the gospel in an authentic way, they should live by example, and Pope Francis is doing it.
From your perspective, Professor Ospino, this is motivated by Pope Francis's genuine commitment to a very intimate relationship with his Catholicism. But the cynics would say this is, you know, pretty incredible marketing. And it's about, really, bottom line, making sure that more people are becoming Catholic and more people are remaining Catholic. So all of these things that you're talking about, is it working? Is it bringing more people into the fold?
So here we have someone who I think is making us an invitation, a radical invitation to say, if you are going to be an authentic Catholic, let's be a real one, you know? And if that translates into numbers in churches, fine. If it doesn't, you know, most likely we're not living what we're supposed to be living. Now, are people changing their minds because of Pope Francis? Well, I think that we will see that down the road, you know. He might be sparking a new generation of leaders and families and children and youth who want to live the gospel in a new way. Will that mean that, you know, people are going to flock to Catholic churches? That may happen in the future. That may not happen. But frankly, I would love to see more people living their religious lives authentically, regardless of the religious commitment they have made until now.
So he's the first pope that is not from Europe in about 1,300 years. He's also the first Jesuit pope. Professor Ospino, for anybody who doesn't know, what exactly is the Jesuit tradition within Catholicism, and why is it important that Pope Francis is the first Jesuit pope?
The Jesuits dedicated themselves to the missions, primarily to working with the poor, but many of them actually became great intellectuals, you know, and they founded schools and universities all throughout the world. Pope Francis, certainly one of them, he joins the Jesuits, and in his biography, in his various remarks, he says, I was attracted to the Jesuits for that commitment, because of that commitment to the missions.
So 55% of Latinos in the United States are Catholic, but one in four Latinos are former Catholics. So while you have younger Latinos less likely to be Catholic, you have the number of Catholics who are Latinos actually growing. How much do you think this is front and center for this particular pope?
I mean, about 43% of all Catholics in the United States are Latino, Hispanic. And we also know, and I think that perhaps the most striking number is the fact that about 60% of all Catholics under the age of 18 happen to be Hispanic. So the present and the future of Catholicism in the United States is intimately linked to the Latino and Latina experience.
Dr. Hoffman Ospino from Boston College. Coming up on Latino USA,
I think it's a different situation because in Argentina, the Catholic Church had a lot of power. But in Cuba, after Fidel Castro came to power, the church was kind of ousted.
Two daughters, two countries, two points of view on El Papa. But first, we learn about Pope Francis's past back when he was just Jorge Bergoglio of Argentina. No se vayan.
Está mi corazón.
Hey, you. So thanks for listening to our special broadcast about the Pope, but I want to ask you to do me a favor. If you love this show and all of our shows, please take a minute to rate and review our show on iTunes. It really makes a big difference. And if you're really motivated by all the love, you can even click on the donate button at latinousa.org and send us that love with a little bit of cash. Thanks, everyone. Gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Gilchrist Foundation, supporting NPR's enduring commitment to making music, arts, and culture accessible to audiences in the Midwest and across America. More information is available at thegilchristfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today, El Papa Francisco and his first ever visit to the United States. Now, of course, for the first 75 years of his life, before he was Pope Francis, he was just Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Buenos Aires.
Yeah, just an ordinary Catholic priest. Born in 1936.
That's WNYC reporter Jim O'Grady, who's here with me in the studio. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Maria.
So you've been talking to a lot of church officials and, in fact, two of the Pope's biographers about key moments in his life. Where's a good place to start?
Let's start in 1973.
We're in Argentina, and Bergoglio is head of the Jesuits there, right?
That's right. He's 36 years old, and they put him in charge of the whole thing. So he's been, at this time, he's been a full-fledged Jesuit for only 2 years, and now he's responsible for and giving orders to all of the Jesuit priests in Argentina.
So in his life, this is essentially Bergoglio's first big leadership position. So how does it go?
Well, there's a Jesuit, a senior Jesuit official who told me that Bergoglio, at this time, is kind of a jerk. And the Pope himself admits this. He says in an interview that back then he was authoritarian. So I asked Father Thomas Kosicki, and he's the current head of the Jesuits in North America, about Bergoglio as a young man, as a young Jesuit.
He acknowledges the mistakes he made, the errors he made, and he did what a younger person would do in leadership. Put his foot down, really gave clear directives, and you were either with him or you were not with him.
That seems kind of totally different to the way that he's operating as a pope, right?
It is totally different. But back then, that was authority was the approach of the church. Think back to 1978. Pope John Paul II is elected. And John Paul grew up in Poland when the church is under siege by first the Nazis and then the communists. And then after that, John Paul considers a threat from materialism and moral relativism of the Western consumer culture. So the imperative for him in the face of all these threats is church unity. And to him, that means obedience to authority.
From the Vatican on down, the message was do not question authority. And essentially, Bergoglio basically plays along, right?
That's right. That was his attitude back then, and it did not always go well. Some of his fellow priests like and admire him, but many do not. And a complicating factor is liberation theology. It's a movement that comes out of South America, and it's very strong at the time, and it stresses overcoming systems of oppression, like the military governments who are operating in the hemisphere, including in Argentina. And Bergoglio is not a fan of liberation theology. Austin Ivory, his biographer, says Bergoglio believes in a different approach to helping the poor.
Bergoglio had a very profound sense that the Jesuits needed to have very direct contact with the ordinary lives of the poor, to be immersed in their lives. He wanted them to be religious, first of all. So he steered the Jesuits away from a temptation, I think, in his view, which is to take refuge in, you know, politics and in revolutionary movements.
But during this time in Argentina, there's the Dirty War.
There is.
Okay, so a little bit of background about the Dirty War. It breaks out in 1974. There's a military coup, then there's a dictatorship, and at the same time, there's a leftist movement, a guerrilla movement, and there are many, many civilians who are desaparecido. They're being disappeared by the military, and it's a very difficult time in the country.
Yes, and the Dirty War is raging during the 6 years that Bergoglio is leading the Jesuits.
Okay, so I'm wondering, how does this disagreement about liberation theology, how does that play into all of this?
Because the junta kidnaps two Jesuit priests from the slums of Buenos Aires.
Because they were activists, essentially.
They were activists. The junta holds these priests for several weeks and tortures them. And some at the time say Bergoglio could have done more to protect the priests, but he didn't do it because these priests were proponents of liberation theology.
So he could have done more?
By almost all accounts, Bergoglio did work very hard to get those priests freed, and Bergoglio saved the lives of other political detainees. But during this time, Bergoglio makes a calculation. He does not publicly condemn human rights violations in Argentina. And his thinking seems to be that by not directly confronting the junta and working behind the scenes, he can free more people and avoid persecution of the Jesuits and the church at large.
So Bergoglio's term as the head of the Jesuits in Argentina ends in 1979.
So then another Jesuit takes over and he says to Bergoglio, okay, we're going to send you to Germany to you can further your academic studies. He's basically saying to him, we're going to get you out of town. And Father Kosicki says that Bergoglio is essentially sent into exile.
He's miserable in Germany, and he admits it. He develops this devotion to Mary the Untier of Knots. No one's heard of that devotion, but, I mean, obviously he was tied in knots living in Germany. He talks about literally going to the airport and looking at the planes, flying to Buenos Aires, because he wants to go back to Argentina. I don't know that he even lasts a year in Germany. So he returns, and they're like, guess who's back?
So he's back, but then they send him right out of town again. They send him away to Córdoba, which is Argentina's second city in the center of the country. And this is where Bergoglio starts to change. He rededicates himself to serving the poor and the marginalized. And he decides that if anyone ever puts him in charge of anything again, he's going to be open. And when he makes a decision, he's going to try to bring people along with him instead of just giving orders. This is how Austin Ivory, the biographer, describes it.
Over time, he just learned a more collegial, more cooperative, and more humble style of governance. And I think that's what you're seeing the fruit of now as Pope Francis.
So Bergoglio actually has this, like change of heart, essentially.
It was a change of heart. And you see it even more when he becomes Archbishop of Buenos Aires in 1998. He adopts this new style. He moves into a small apartment. He cooks his own meals. He rides a bus to work.
Right. And that continues to this day. I mean, he deliberately chose not to live in the Papal Palace, but in a small set of rooms. And he does things like washing the feet of prisoners.
Yeah, exactly so. And all those added up, those symbolic gestures are what has woken up the world to this new figure. And people are saying, wow, this pope is different. Because very broadly speaking, there are two factions in the Catholic Church. And one of the factions says, church doctrine is true and it comes from God and it shouldn't change. And another faction says, parts of the doctrine, they do need to change, if only to close the gap between Catholic teaching and how many good Catholics actually live their lives, especially in the United States.
So do you think that there's really a chance that Pope Francis could actually change church teaching on big issues?
To be honest, everyone I talk to says probably not. But what he has done already is he's changed the tone to one of mercy and acceptance and of dialogue.
But he is the Pope. He is powerful. I mean, he could change church doctrine if he wanted to, right? Because he does have the final say, right?
That's right. He's the Pope. But there's this other very important issue that one of his biographers, Jimmy Burns, points out. There's a danger in religion of schism, of one side not accepting change and just walking away.
What he doesn't want to do is go down in history as the Pope that has split the church in two, as the Pope that has created some sort of breakaway, and the whole thing is he leaves a complete chaos behind.
So Pope Francis, he is changing the way the Vatican works. He's making it more transparent. He's cleaning up the notorious banking system. And that is bothering a lot of entrenched interests in Rome.
Okay, so what do you think we can expect from the Pope's visit to the United States?
Well, okay, so Jimmy Burns, his biographer, has been with Francis on some of his trips abroad. And here's what he says.
What Americans are going to find absolutely extraordinary is just kind of the enthusiasm this guy generates from ordinary people at street level.
So what I think you could expect is the revival of a word that was coined when John Paul II first came to America, and that is Pope Mania.
Well, thanks, Jim. I feel like you gave me a much better sense of Bergoglio's life in Argentina now, so thanks a lot.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Jim O'Grady is a reporter at WNYC right here in New York City.
Until Francis became Pope, soccer star Lionel Messi was probably the most influential Argentinian in the world. But in the same way some Argentinians are annoyed that Messi hasn't won them a World Cup yet, not all Argentinians are on the Papa Francisco train. Queens, in New York, is one of the largest Argentinian strongholds in the country. WNYC producer Julia Longoria visited Corona, a neighborhood in Queens, to survey the crowd. And she reported back to our own resident Argentinian, Latino USA producer Antonia Cerejido.
Hey, Julia.
Hey, Antonia. Yeah, so I went to Corona and I met this guy, Daniel Green, who I met at the corner of Corona and Junction. There's this place called Club Rio Platense, where all these old men gather on around these card tables. And they're just like being ridiculous and wonderful and drunk.
Think about it in Argentina. It's like you're in a sardine can, you know? And he would go in the bus every day. And he was the archbishop of, that's unheard of. And he would go to the slums and help the people there.
Archbishop taking the bus. You know what I think is great is that the Pope has been like portrayed as this like really humble guy, and I believe that he's a humble guy. And you're from Miami, so you probably know this, but Argentinians do not have that rep.
Right. Well, I mean, I didn't mean it like that. Right.
I mean, you know.
Yes, Argentinians have this reputation, which he was talking about. The stereotype is that they're snobby or something like that,
yeah,
right?
Proud and difficult.
Yeah, no, totally. I actually talked to this woman, Monica Flores, who is, she's a Spanish teacher in the city now, and she actually was a student at the time that the junta started, you know, like all the dirty war stuff started. For her, the Catholic Church's involvement at that time as sort of an institution with some power in Argentina, the fact that they didn't do anything made her leave the church. This is her talking about her and her friends who also were in the university at the time and were rebels. And now looking back and thinking about this Pope coming to power, she's kind of in a funny position.
We were laughing because we said, we are in this ridiculous position that we are defending the Pope. We never imagined.
Wow.
She's wonderful.
Wait, so were there any Pope haters?
There weren't quite haters, but this one guy, Guillermo, was kind of like lukewarm about the Pope. And he said that it isn't really the Pope's job to fix politics.
El Papa puede ir, hablar, y después todo siga, al otro día sigue igual. A no ser que el Papa gobierne.
What this man just said was that the Pope really can't fix anything because he's not a politician.
Right. If he were the president, then maybe he could fix something. But otherwise, like, the Pope, in his opinion, doesn't have any business talking about politics.
Beyond just reporting on people's feelings about the Pope, we invited you here because you and I realized that we have this connection that's, like, weirdly Pope-related.
Yeah, I am the daughter of a Cuban exile, and you are the daughter of an Argentine one.
Right. And our fathers left their respective countries for very different reasons. But the Pope has become the symbol of hope for both of them.
Why did your dad leave?
So my family is Jewish, and a lot of like leftist liberal Jews were very targeted during the dirty wars. And my family was targeted, and my father's family now lives in Mexico City. But my dad never expected to really care about the papacy.
In general, I regarded the papacy as sort of a repressive force and not the best part of the Christian religion, say.
It's funny having listened to those other people's reactions because it sounds like all these people have gone through all these different emotions about it, and my dad has gone through all of those emotions. He's gone on this like emotional journey about how he's felt about the Pope.
When it was announced that it was Bergoglio, I felt like, oh, no. Then I felt elation, like, yay, Argentinian Pope, Latin American Pope.
When did your dad leave Cuba?
My dad left in 1970.
Okay.
And he left, he was 13 years old, and he left after his family was actually in support of the revolution at first. In 1959, my grandfather smuggled guns to Castro.
Wow.
And then it was because actually of the church and because of the posture that Fidel had toward the Catholic Church that my family felt like they were being persecuted, basically, mm-hmm. and had to just get out of there.
The funny thing to me now is that the Pope, even though he's like all the way in the Vatican and super distant, still feels like he has a very big impact on my family. Is that something that your father feels?
I think it's a different situation because in Argentina, the Catholic Church had a lot of power. But in Cuba, after Fidel Castro came to power, the church was kind of ousted. And my grandfather lived in Hilara in Oriente, and his friends in the neighborhood were these two priests who were kind of asked to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad had this experience of, like, feeling oppressed.
A lot of people would feel all excited that there's a Latin American pope, it's a nationalistic thing, it's a Latin American thing. But it's very different for Cubans because the church was thrown out of Cuba.
But does he feel maybe that the pope is kind of... or making Catholicism more relevant, making it relevant again.
Totally, totally.
I mean, I think that there is a general excitement about hearing from this man who came from very humble background. This pope is cool. I mean, people just, you can't help thinking that. Can you? I mean, this guy's amazing.
Yeah, and I think, like, we are very Catholic, unlike your family, but my aunt was in the seminary. Like, we take a lot of pride in being Catholic, mm-hmm. but also there's this attitude of, like, the Catholic Church is super imperfect, and there's so many things that are just awful that the Catholic Church has done. And the way to address that is not to leave it, but to, like, try to be part of it and try
right.
to, like, struggle with it. And so to see this pope who seems to have a lot of the same postures that my family does is so cool. It's like,
wow.
You know, like it's like
that's amazing.
Something's finally changing. Maybe your dad had a similar experience of like now this pope is actually getting involved in that history of the
yeah.
dirty war.
He said that he would reopen the Vatican archives on the Argentine dictatorship. I just thought it was a magnificent thing, an incredible thing.
That meant so much to my father. He was really beside himself. The other thing is that my dad watches soccer every day religiously. That's his real religion, is soccer, straight up. And the fact that El Papa is like a huge soccer fan to my dad is like everything.
He's unabashedly a fan of a soccer team from Argentina. This week, they're going to play against Boca Juniors, and he already said, we're going to win. Just, I think it's such a dash of fresh air.
That's wonderful. My dad went to art school and is just, like, totally failed me on the, like, soccer, becoming a soccer fan.
Your dad's an artist?
Yeah.
My dad's an artist.
Really?
Yeah.
My dad went to art school, but he's a toy inventor, actually.
That's so cool.
What kind of art does
my
your dad
do? My dad does like visual. He does like video installation work. Yeah.
Cool.
That's so crazy. This is getting crazier and crazier. Oh my god.
They really should be
yeah.
friends.
Yeah.
Maybe your dad can teach my dad.
They're
like how to
secretly
like soccer.
The same person.
That was Julia Longoria, producer of WNYC's Money Talking podcast, speaking with our own Antonia Cerejido. Last week, we asked you to send us your thoughts about Pope Francis, and we got a number of responses, most of them positive. So here's what some of you had to say. Teresa Romero said she appreciated the fact that Francis seems to be a follower of the red letters, meaning the actual spoken words of Jesus in the Bible.
We see in Pope Francis a genuine Christian believer who is aiming to set up this bar of emulating the very actions that Jesus called us to, which is in the greatest commandment, to love God with all our heart.
Ray Perez said he takes issue with the buzz surrounding Francis.
The world and society we're living in is so off-kilter that his words, instead of making perfect sense, sound like radical ideas.
But not everyone likes Pope Francis, of course. Reporter Brooke Binkowski talked to Hector Gastelum. He's a Mexican-American realtor in California, and he's not a fan of the Pope's economic message.
Attacking free market capitalism and trying to redistribute the wealth, where he has the view of the rich nations need to help the poor nations. We in America, we believe in personal responsibility. We need to help them, not with money, with teaching them how free market helps the poor people the most.
And you can always send us your thoughts about our show or what we're covering or anything, really, by going to our website, latinousa.org, or you can tweet us at LatinoUSA. Coming up, the path to sainthood for two very different men from Catholic history.
To be a saint is the highest you can be in the Catholic Church for a human being. He just doesn't deserve that promotion.
Who gets venerated and why? That's next on Latino USA. Stay with us. Hey there. Before we get back to our show, I want to tell you about a few recent interviews you can check out on Fresh Air's podcast. Host Terry Gross interviewed Jonathan Franzen about his new novel. She spoke with the author of a book about autism and the myths surrounding it. And she did a tribute to neurologist Oliver Sacks, featuring a couple of her interviews with Sacks from Fresh Air's archive. You'll find those and many other great Fresh Air interviews on npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security at Cigna.com. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, an online resource dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students with information and strategies about what works in K-12 education. Learn more at Edutopia.org.
It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today we're talking about a truly 21st century Pope, Pope Francis, beloved by many, but not without controversy, because Pope Francis plans to canonize Junipero Serra as a saint. Father Serra was active in the late 1700s when he helped Spain colonize what is now California. So he oversaw forced conversion of tens of thousands of indigenous people to Catholicism. Today, descendants of those indigenous people are still grappling with Junipero Serra's legacy. Here's Shireen Marisol Meraji, a member of NPR's Code Switch team, with more.
San Francisco's Mission District is now known as the urban playground for Silicon Valley tech geeks. But its name comes from the Catholic mission established more than two centuries ago under Father Junipero Serra. Today, what's left is the simple adobe church and cemetery, where 5,700 Indians from various California tribes are buried, mostly in unmarked graves.
My name is Andrew Galvin.
Okay, my name is Vincent Medina.
Here at Mission Dolores in San Francisco, and we're standing in our cemetery.
Standing next to the grave marker of my
great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents.
60-year-old Andrew Galvin is the museum director of Mission Dolores in San Francisco. He's responsible for planning exhibits and hiring tour guides like 28-year-old Vincent Medina, his assistant now. They're Ohlone, a tribe from the northern and central California coast, and they met 6 years ago through their individual work around Mission Indian cultural restoration. It turns out they're cousins who can trace their roots to a married couple buried here in the early 1800s.
Jacques Bachme and Poilemja,
who were baptized at Mission Dolores, had their wedding at Mission Dolores, their funerals inside the church.
And they're both from villages very close to here.
Galvin, who's been the museum director for more than a decade, had a simple wooden grave marker placed in the cemetery to acknowledge his ancestors. He put a tule house directly across from it. The shelter looks like a hut made of dry reeds stacked next to and on top of each other. Ohlone family slept in them before the arrival of Father Sarah and his mission system. Galvin says this is where he and Medina start all of their tours, between the tule house and their ancestors' grave marker, in a cemetery filled with gravestones for Spanish and Mexican Catholics.
Because what we want to do is talk about them and their journey to the mission, and then we talk about the recreated Indian dwelling that we have for here for interpretive purposes. Then we move into the mission. It's the same transition our ancestors made, so we take the visitor through that transition.
They are the only descendants of Mission Indians hired to do this work in any of the 21 California missions. And Medina makes sure visitors on his guided tours understand that transition Galvin's talking about, that tens of thousands of Indians up and down the coast of California underwent, was rough.
People were enslaved in the missions. They were whipped if they spoke their language. Girls who were unwed were locked in dorms that were filthy. People, if they tried to escape, were forcibly brought back and flogged and punished, kept in stocks. People were starving. People were getting diseases. They were horrible places to be.
But both Galvin and Medina say they're living proof that their people survived this abuse and persevered. They learned to adapt to the Spanish ways and later the Mexican ways and then the Anglo ways. But they were able to keep a piece of the old ways because their ancestors left cultural clues behind.
This is our sanctuary, the most sacred space where the altar table is, where the priest presides at worship.
Galvin, Medina, and I are standing at the front of the narrow adobe church. Behind us is a Baroque wall filled with saints and painted with lots of gold flair. But if you look up at the ceiling in front of you, you start thinking, one of these things is not like the others. The geometric pattern is intricate, and its straight lines are in direct contrast to the fancy swirls of the Baroque art beneath it.
So the entire ceiling from the front door to the back wall is painted in what is a traditional basket weave pattern. And to me also, it shows how my ancestors, they were still going to factor in their own culture into this building that they were being forced essentially to make.
Even though they know their people were forced and coerced into Catholicism, Medina and Galvin are both practicing Catholics. They say it's a part of their cultural traditions now, that lots of people's history with the church is colored by colonialism, and they're still Catholic. But Galvin takes it even further with his unwavering belief that Junipero Serra loved Indians and wanted the best for them, which at that time, he says, meant accepting the gospel. He's been fighting for Serra's sainthood for as long as Medina has been alive.
In my eyes, he's a saint. In the official documents of the church, on the afternoon of September the 23rd, Pope Francis will be reading the formula that declares him a saint in Washington, D.C.
A day Galvin has been waiting for and Medina is dreading.
To be a saint is the highest you can be in the Catholic Church for a human being. He just doesn't deserve that promotion, like, for me. Like, that's, like, why it's upsetting. And to me, I just can't support it, because a lot of the effects of the missions are still being felt by Ohlone people even today.
He mentions the loss of cultural traditions, basket weaving, spiritual ceremonies, and language. Medina spent years trying to relearn his ancestral language, Chochenyo, from old recordings. But Galvin doesn't blame Junipero Serra for those losses. He blames the colonial system.
He is a person of that time. It is not correct to judge him by our standards.
I can't support the canonization because of that. I just can't.
How do you work with him every day then?
Well, Andy would often say, good scholarship is listening to the other side.
Exactly what I was going to say. Good scholarship is listening to both sides of a point. Because in many ways, Vincent and I agree more on what happened at a California mission than what we disagree on.
They agree that the mission system could be brutal, but it's also the strongest link to their ancestral past, their history. Vincent Medina wants some of the things that were taken away returned. He wants the missions to offer language classes and basketry, to be a place where traditional ceremonies can be performed right alongside the Catholic faith. And he's hoping the spotlight on Father Junipero Serra's sainthood can help make that happen.
If we can take something that I perceive as being negative, channel that frustration into some good, then ultimately we win in the end. We all win. You know, Andy gets his saints, I get Indians in the mission.
Thanks to Shireen Marisol Meraji for that story of the controversial canonization of Junipero Serra. Now, before someone can be canonized as a saint in the Catholic Church, they first have to be beatified, which is a fancy way of saying that they officially got into heaven. This past May, the late Archbishop of San Salvador, Monsignor Oscar Romero, was beatified by Pope Francis. Now, this is the same Oscar Romero who was part of the liberation theology movement that Pope Francis was critical of. During El Salvador's civil war, Romero took a stand in favor of social justice and against the violence of the military regime, and his supporters say he paid for that with his life. 35 years later, the Vatican's first Latin American pope has put Oscar Romero on the path to sainthood, but his followers still struggle. Reporter Osa Volander takes us to El Salvador now.
The police team that handles gang violence speeds through San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. A 30-year-old man has just been killed right in the middle of a crowded street. The murder is not the first this week, not the first today. Violence has skyrocketed in El Salvador recently, mostly because of the maras, the street gangs. In May alone, there were over 600 murders here, which made it the most violent month since the civil war of the 1980s. If this trend keeps up, El Salvador is likely to pass Honduras as the world's most violent country outside a war zone. But there is another side of El Salvador, one that prays for a country free of bloodshed. That's the side represented by those who've gathered for the beatification ceremony of Oscar Romero. In the Catholic Church, this is the last step before canonization. But a lot of people here already consider Romero a saint. 23-year-old Veronica Argentina has traveled all night to arrive in time.
Dio la vida por nosotros y más que todo pues por su pueblo, por la grande injusticia que padeció pues el país y que hoy en día pues.
He gave his life for us, for the people, Veronica says. There is still a lot of injustice, but we hope there'll be a change and that this can be a sign of peace. When Oscar Romero became Archbishop of San Salvador in 1977, he was seen as conservative and had good relations with the US-backed military dictatorship. Then his close friend and colleague, the radical priest Rutilio Grande, was murdered. The government, which he had criticized, was believed responsible for the killing. But that was just the beginning of a long period of unrest. From 1980 to 1992, 75,000 people were killed in a civil war between the right-wing regime and leftist guerrillas. During the build-up to the war, Romero chose to stand with the poor.
Yo quisiera hacer un llamamiento de manera especial a los hombres del ejército.
In his sermon of March 23, 1980, Romero spoke directly to the country's military and police with an appeal to follow God's law, not to kill.
En nombre de Dios, pues, y en nombre de este sufrido pueblo, cuyos lamentos suben hasta el cielo cada día más tumultuosos, les suplico, les ruego, les ordeno en nombre de Dios.
In the name of God, and in the name of these suffering people, whose cries every day rise more tumultuous to heaven, I beg you, I plead, I order in the name of God, stop the repression, Romero declared. The next day he was shot dead in front of the altar during a church service in the chapel Divina Providencia. A military intelligence officer has been blamed for ordering the killing, but no one has ever been prosecuted. In death, as in life, Romero remains a controversial figure, even within the Catholic Church. Many people associate him with liberation theology, which focuses on social justice.
Hola, buenas tardes.
But John Sobrino, a priest and close colleague of Romero, says he didn't care much about labels.
No, no era un experto en teología de la liberación, ni le preocupaba. Romero simpatizó con Jesús de Nazaret, que luchó por la liberación de los pobres de su pueblo.
He wasn't an expert at liberation theology, and he didn't worry much about it, John says. Romero sympathized with Jesus, who fought for the liberation of the poor. Still, it's taken the Argentine Pope Francis, who's considered less conservative than his predecessors, to beatify Romero.
Este Papa tenía un modo bastante diferente.
This Pope has a different style when it comes to facing certain problems, John says. For the beatification ceremony, Pope Francis sent Cardinal Angelo Amato to represent the Vatican.
Hermanas y hermanos, hoy es una fiesta grande aquí en El Salvador.
Today is a big party in El Salvador and in heaven, the Cardinal says. But not far from the streets where hundreds of thousands are celebrating, there's a different story.
Entonces, en esta zona,
Gerardo Mendes drives uphill between the barrios of Montreal and Finca Argentina, crossing invisible borders. As a priest, trying to maintain a dialogue with the Maras, he's one of the few civilians who gets a little bit of respect here. But it's a constant balancing act.
Bueno, esa relación es realmente no es una relación que a veces pasa por momentos de tensiones, ¿no?
There's always tension, he explains. You can't come down on them too hard. You'd lose their trust that way. But there's also a risk they'll use the church for their own purposes. It's not enough just to have goodwill in this.
No es suficiente tener buena voluntad, ¿no? Ah, mira, ahí está el abuelo.
Part of Gerardo's mission as a priest is to steer young people away from crime. He says there are local people within the church doing good work, following the legacy of Oscar Romero. But he's not too impressed with the church's higher-ups.
No hay tanta reacción por parte de la iglesia que cuestionan pues todas las medidas represivas de que se están dando, ¿no? Se nota un poco que hay una pasividad.
They aren't speaking out against the government being heavy-handed instead of addressing the roots of poverty and violence, he explains. They're too passive. We need a strong voice like Romero's to question the oppression and open people's eyes. Gerardo works out of a local storefront church. Here, a choir is singing about Monsignor Romero. Gerardo stands at the back, watching the seats fill up. Just outside, Sara Soriano is selling tamales, listening to the tribute.
Es satisfacción, alegría, porque sí saber de que hubo alguien que sí peleó por estos problemas por nosotros.
It feels good to know that there was someone who fought against the problems here, who fought for us, and that his words are still heard, she says. This neighborhood is dominated by the gang Mara Salvatrucha, also known as MS-13. A few blocks away is the territory of Barrio 18. But Sara's world is the church. The parish has helped her find a place to live and to make sure her daughter Alicia receives medical care.
A raíz de un accidente tenía año y medio y ella, primeramente, ella quedó.
When Alicia was 1.5 years old, she was hit by a gunshot aimed at a gang member on a bus. Now she's 7 and in a wheelchair. She'll always have to live with the wounds in her lungs and spine. It hurts to live like this when you can't go from one block to another without being threatened, says Sara. She knows her situation is just one more sign that the fight for peace in El Salvador is yet to be won. The weapons may have changed hands, but Oscar Romero's words are as relevant as ever.
Thanks to reporter Ursa Villander in El Salvador for that story. And speaking of relevant words, every week at the end of our show, we bring you some sabiduría, or words of wisdom. So it felt fitting to bring you some wise words from the Pope himself, as told to us by Hosman Ospino, who we heard from earlier in our show. Ospino shares with us something the Pope said that stuck with him.
Pope Francis, when he was in Brazil, he met with the Argentinian youth, and with these jóvenes, you know, he was speaking, and he said something that I just love, and I think that applies not only to Argentinian youth, but applies to every young person in the entire world. vayan y hagan lío. Go and make noise. Go and be troublemakers in your dioceses, in your parishes, in your neighborhoods. You know, this is the time for young people to be protagonistas, to be the protagonists of their lives and of their faith. Challenge everyone to live an authentic Christian witness.
Professor Ospino and Pope Francis are right. And I can say that as a journalist, there's nothing more important than people challenging authority and questioning everything. But of course, Pope Francis now is that authority, the very authority that he says we should always try to challenge. Now, the truth is, I made a big, huge lío when, as a college student, I told my Catholic family in Mexico that I was leaving the church because I couldn't fathom what it had done to the indigenous people of Latin America. That, and a lot of the hypocrisy of preaching love, but really being unloving to the poor, is what made me turn away. But here's the thing. I'm fascinated by this Pope. So while I'm sure I will not see him because I do not have a ticket, I will be going to see all of the crowds seeing him because I want to feel some of that love. I know, it's complicated, but the Pope is a pretty joyful rebel now, and I like that. And, mis queridos listeners, that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by Michael Simon Johnson, Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Maggie Freeland. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. And special thanks to our partners for today's show at WNYC in New York, especially Julianne Welby and Charlie Herman. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima, everyone.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I'm pretty sure we discovered that you guys went to the same Snoop Dogg concert.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org. And the Annie E. Casey Foundation, with more than 25 years of Kids Count data on the well-being of America's children, providing access to national and local information, as well as state rankings. Learn more at datacenter.kidscount.org. This is NPR.